addition to those things that an individual can and should do for themselves in handling stresses on the job, there are a whole variety of things that members of management ought to be actively looking at in terms of things that they can control. One of the best understood of these is the concept of job enrichment. From the work of Frederick Hertzberg and a number of other industrial and organizational psychologists, we understand that people look for self-meaning in the work that they do. That is, the work becomes an extension of themselves. Now suppose that we have an employee who all day long does a very rote, repetitious job with so many mechanical motions per hour, an assembly line kind of job. Some people may like that kind of work, but a majority of people don't. A majority of people report that they like variety. A majority of people report that they like a sense of importance in what they're doing, a sense of meaning in what they're doing. And when we find a job that reflects back to us an image that all you're good for is doing robot work, all you're good for is doing mindless work, it says something about us that we don't want to hear. In such environments, it's often found that unionization proceeds rapidly, that work becomes an adversarial relationship. On the other hand, when people have a sense that their job is more important than it was yesterday, that today my boss has given me something to do, he's increased my responsibility level, that too represents a very positive, concrete signal. My boss trusts me. My boss apparently thinks I can handle this. It's a test that she's giving to me. I don't mind that. I kind of enjoy it. It's a little more variety. I like testing myself in this world. I like proving to them and proving to myself that I can do better and I can do more. So how can we create enriched jobs? A number of corporations across the United States have been playing with this idea for about the last 15 years, perhaps none more than AT&T. For many years, under the able direction of their fine human resources department, AT&T did a lot of work showing that all kinds of jobs, even the most routine or most mundane of jobs, can be made more important by enriching or by adding a greater variety and a greater weight to the job tasks. What could be done in your own work environment to do that? Employees might be able to suggest it, but only members of management have the political clout and the organizational authority to make it happen. A second suggestion for leaders in the workplace to consider in reducing employee stress is to find ways to reduce organizational conflict. There are going to be rub points that occur between departments and between individuals, and yet many of our organizations act as though the act of fighting was a bad thing, and that people who complain about what somebody else is doing are troublemakers. And we put all of these negative labels on people, and we assign all kinds of negative values to people who are really doing nothing more than reacting to the fact that not everything is peaceful within a big group of people. Now, there are ways that you can handle these kinds of conflicts, and the fact that there is a need for them is seen sometimes in unionization drives where the unions will promise and use as a lever to gain authority with potential union members the argument that if you vote for the union, they will install a grievance procedure. Now, it's a heck of a price for a management to pay if employees have to buy a union simply because they were unable to get management to recognize the fact that we sometimes are going to fight with each other. Any marriage counselor will tell you that sometimes a good fight is absolutely beneficial to the marriage. And we understand now from principles of conflict management that conflict often arises not because people are troublemakers, but because perhaps there's been too much change. Expectations are unclear, or communications are poor. We're all trying so hard to get our jobs done that we just bump into each other occasionally. But when that happens, let's not label each other as bad folks. Let's instead have some rules, some techniques, some systems whereby this can be handled. There's a lot of ways of doing it. A grievance procedure is kind of formal and ponderous, but that might be an improvement over doing nothing at all. There are lots of informal ways to do it. In some groups, they have employee meetings, and employees are free to appeal to a group of their fellows in terms of saying, what do you think should be done? and these employees' recommendations are listened to very carefully by management. There are all kinds of ways in which this has been tested and shown to work. And management literature in the area of conflict resolution is replete with many such examples. The test question for any management is, have you provided channels of appeal, channels of grievance handling, channels of communication? Have you found ways to allow employees to get around the supervisor to higher levels of management if that supervisor does not take appropriate action, and at the same time to not undercut the supervisor's role of authority with the employee? A third element that I think members of management need to look at in consideration of reducing the stress so everybody can work a little easier is to increase the dynamics of communication. Often when I'm in corporate environments, I will notice that the amount of talent and effort and money that has been put into formal communications is really a marvelous thing. You'll see some of the slickest, best examples of employee newsletters, magazines, very thorough general list notice distribution, all that kind of formal paper that says, hey, we really do have good attitudes about communication and we want to communicate. But beyond that, is there an attitude of open communication? In other words, if I was an employee and I went to any member of management that I might report to and I said, hey, I want to know what our strategic plan is, could that supervisor find out for me if he didn't know? Could he pick up the phone and instantly have an answer to that question? If I want to know exactly what the salary ranges are in another job, in another department for which I might be considered, can I find out that information? A number of companies keep salary information super secret. If I want another job in another department, do I have to wait for somebody in personnel to anoint me? Or is that something that I can initiate directly on my own? How available are the top executives? And more importantly, what kind of reaching out behaviors do we see from executives toward employees? Forget the open door concept, because the open door policy basically relies on the employee coming to the executive. How come the employee has to put out that kind of effort? Why isn't the executive walking through that open door out to the employee in shirt sleeves and holding shop floor meetings and getting the dynamism back into communication? Communication is not paper. Communication is me talking to you, one-on-one, no holds barred, no games playing, no limits. Just lay it on the table and tell me where we've got problems and where we don't. Tell me I'm terrific. Tell me all the other things I want to hear, and let's get past being so very careful in how we choose our words. When people have a sense of being in the know, when people have a sense that management is not playing games with them, they just seem to relax. It's one less thing they have to worry about. All things being equal, I think we'd all rather work that way. Another prescription for organizational stress handling is that the human resources people and members of management throughout the organization should enforce vacation taking. You'll have a small percentage of people who basically do not take vacations. They may, whatever your salary policy allows, either be able to accrue time, or they may take the vacation time simply as extra cash in the envelope, but they're not taking the break away from the job that is essential. We now know that breaks are necessary and that we can certainly be flexible in how we allow the person to take the break time, but there ought to be a policy provision that does not allow carryover or cash payments beyond some reasonable period of time. A fifth idea in the area of possible management intervention to reduce stress is to see if you can build work teams. Organizations are typically organized vertically. That is, it's a very clear chain of command that runs from the president down to the lowest level of the employee pyramid. And as clear and as concise as our structuring has been of the organization vertically, it has not, in most cases, organized itself adequately horizontally. When we build work teams, what we're saying is, look, if an employee in one department wants to talk to an employee in another department, they don't have to go up through 13 levels in their own chain of command and then have it come down 13 levels in the other department's chain of command. Instead, Ralph can call up Sue on the phone and say, hey, let's get together. We've got a problem between our two departments. One of the things that's really exciting right now with American industry's very intense involvement with quality work circles and other forms of participative management is that it is, for the first time, moving aggressively to build these kinds of team relationships across department lines. In one major pharmaceutical organization, it was found that when they organized research scientists by discipline and put all of the biologists in one department and all of the chemists in another department and all of the physical scientists in another department, the rate of innovation of new patentable items, of new pharmaceutical product discoveries, tended to be at a relatively low level. The organization itself imposed so many barriers to communication and built in so many time delays to communication that all of these highly paid specialists were experiencing the frustration of trying to do their job and yet not being able to work with each other as colleagues. When that same organization regrouped and set up project teams where all those people in biology and chemistry and physics and all of the other many disciplines were organized by the disease entity with which they were particularly involved, for example, cancer or hypertension, and put them into a collaborative work team arrangement that went across department lines, what happened in the subsequent 5-year period was the rate of innovation, ideas, and patentable products went up dramatically. It simply increased the kind of dynamism and the kind of synergy that can occur between employees. By removing yet another barrier, management also removed another source of stress. A sixth area of careful consideration for members of management that will reduce stress in employees is to not manage by objectives, but to manage by clearly communicated objectives. Not MBO, but MBCO. I don't want to know how many objectives you have or how many procedure manuals you've got to spell them out. What I want to know is, what specifically do employees understand to be their objectives in the coming period? Do all employees have in mind a clearly understood pattern of 2 or 3 items that they're to accomplish in the next work period? Whether that's for a month or a quarter, what is it specifically that you want them to get done? Often we hear the complaint from employees, and it is so common a finding for me to hear this on attitude opinion surveys and in group interviews, that they don't know what it is they are expected to do. Oh, they know the tasks they're supposed to do day in and day out, but they don't really know what it is they are expected to accomplish or what standards they are to meet. What we see clearly across the board is that management has all kinds of MBO charts they've written out for themselves, but the people at the operating level don't know what these things are. MBO is worthless. Only management by clear, communicated objectives means anything. And when you take the time to communicate very clearly what your expectations are, then nobody has to guess. Nobody has to read minds. Nobody has to wonder what it takes to please you. Nobody has to read the tea leaves to figure out what is required around here to look like a winner. All things being equal, I'd like to do exactly what you want, so that you think I'm terrific. That's where my promotion is going to come from. That's where my salary increase is going to come from. It's pathetic to see how many employees are only carrying out their job mechanically because they do not understand how the objectives of the corporation relate to their specific job duties. A seventh suggestion related to the concept of stress management is to give clear priority to work tasks and assignments and to delegate thoroughly. One of the things that we often will hear from employees is that he wants me to do this, this, and the other thing. She's asking me to do these 16 things, and I really don't know what I'm supposed to do first. And it's not that these people are dumb or unable to use their own intelligence, but they really often have no conceptualization of what priorities have now become hot. If members of management can, when they give employee assignments, say, this is an A priority, this is a B priority, this is a C priority, and not make everything an A priority, then they've helped the employee. Or the employee is called into the boss's office and the boss says, hey, let's review all the things we've talked about off and on over the last 2 weeks. And how many A priorities do you have? Well, I've got 7 of them, boss. Well, of those, these are the 2 I'm most concerned about. I guess we'll call these A prime or A plus priorities. Use whatever letter or numbering system or categorization or classification system you want, but establish priorities clearly. Otherwise, the employee is left to flounder, and if they pick the lower priority that they thought was what you wanted, you're going to do nothing but chew them out later. That means they've lost again. It means another bad night at home after they've left the office. Related to this concept of how we give people work to do is the concept of delegation. The common complaint among managers, as well as employees, is that they're often given the responsibility to do a job, but not given a commensurate measure of authority. That's not delegation. That's kind of like saying, I'm going to give you something to do, but I'm going to make all the decisions. That's not delegation. Delegation means, here's the task to be done. You go do it, Tiger. You've got the authority. And if you're not willing to give them total authority in all things, then spell out the B and C areas where they're going to have to check with you first, or whether they're going to have to at least report back to you. Let them know what the conditions are that may exist under delegation. But 85% of the time, as a general rule, the employee should have complete authority to act on an A level of authority. An 8th area for involvement of management in terms of reducing stress is to take a very close look at who is being put into management positions. Nearly a third of the people who are in supervision should not be there. They are incompetent. They are not suited to such positions, and they have a very negative effect on the lives of their subordinates. Some of these people should never have been selected for supervisory roles. How good are your selection procedures? Make sure you're appointing management people who are not going to create a hell in the work environment. And then when you have people in those chairs, let's be sure that you're giving them the appropriate tools to do their job. It's unfair to take good men or women who basically get along all right with people, but who don't really know what they're supposed to do in management. What's expected of them? They don't really understand all of the functions and responsibilities of their role. They'll learn rapidly if someone looks after their supervisory training and their management development needs. When you consider your managers, you have to be very concerned about their performance appraisal. If a manager has not performed well in the past period, that isn't necessarily a time for punishment, but it certainly is a time for laying out an action plan and a development plan of what you're going to do with and for that person. If your experience with this individual over a period of time is not favorable, then by all means use performance evaluation as a way to remove people who should not be functioning as supervisors from that capacity. In case after case of companies that have become unionized, it has generally been found that the prime ingredient, the number one cause, has not been wages, it's not been benefits, it has not been even the absence of a grievance procedure. Instead, it is employee-manager relations. Typically, in union situations, union organizers will look for those 2 or 3 people who definitely should not be supervisors and who have created so much alienation and so much personal animosity that the union organizers can personalize the issues. And using that as a rallying point can get worker antipathy and unhappiness stirred up to the point where they will vote for the union. Supervisors and members of management do not have tenure. If you've got a bad one, get him out of there, because he's going to do nothing but create additional stress and is actually a risk to your business. Good supervisors should also practice what I call the supervisory C's. They should be in contact with employees, knowing exactly what's going on with them, reacting to what they find. They should confront employees when employees are not performing. You're not making a stress-free world for them by ignoring their problem behaviors. Confront those behaviors. Help them get over it, past it. They should coach employees, teaching, showing how to do the job better, acting as the kindly, fatherly, motherly, big brother, big sister kind of coach that will help them develop and be better. counseling employees, feeding back, reflecting back to them the kinds of things that they should be doing, showing a lot of concern for and confidence in them. Understanding and responding to the basic human need to hear the message, I believe in you. And when we maximize the supervisory C's, we have a positive, stress-reducing impact on people. Lastly, in this list are some questions for managers and executives to consider. Are you using the merciful T's? Sometimes there is a need for mercy. Are you troubleshooting? Are you really identifying and diagnosing what's wrong? Are you training people, or are you putting them into situations where they can't do it just because they don't know how? Are you then treating that person for whatever performance deficiencies there are? How about transfer? Are you moving them maybe to an area where they can do a job and be successful and feel good? Or are you keeping them in a job that they should never have been placed in the first place? To help reduce stress, are you terminating people that you can do nothing for and who by their very presence are simply adding to the stress of other personnel and the unhappiness of a unit and the general tension overall? Sometimes termination is most helpful for the person who is terminated and who can then go on and be successful in another organization. We've suggested several major areas of involvement in terms of handling job stress. We suggested some first aid measures that individual employees can practice, as well as some longer-term approaches to the jobs that we all should consider. And secondly, we've talked about an arena of management responsibility in which management can take some action to prevent stress in employees. A third, very exciting and new area in the overall stress management puzzle at work is the development of corporate wellness programs. This has probably been one of the fastest growing, even mushrooming areas of corporate involvement in stress managing. We have seen a major transformation from the older concept of industrial health programs, which basically involved a part-time doctor and nurse sitting in a little office somewhere with the band-aids, to extensively coordinated programs including health professionals, human resources people, and the top corporate executives moving aggressively into a human potentials concept of how to deal with people at work. This human potentials concept has ramifications far beyond the stress management impacts. Let me deal first with those and then talk about some of the other consequences seen in corporate wellness programs. A variety of corporate wellness programs have emerged from two main sources. One has been the realization that Japan and some companies in the United States have done an extremely good job of mobilizing and utilizing their human resources. They've done that through entirely new concepts of how to deal with and relate to people at work, resulting in highly productive, highly positive atmospheres for greater idea flow. Looking at human relations and the human dynamics of organizations has been a major focal point in the evolution of some of these corporate wellness programs. How can we use our people better? How can we make them feel better? How can we get them more excited about their jobs? A second impetus for corporate wellness programs has come from the growing realization that healthcare costs in the United States have gone totally through the roof. The costs that corporations are now having to absorb for what is basically a treatment orientation to health care are unnecessary and unacceptable. We are spending most of our money in the health care delivery system for the high end of the health care spectrum, that is, hospital care and other acute levels of care. One of the things that has been documented for over 50 years is the fact that dollar for dollar, if you spend money on the prevention aspects of health care, you'll get a lot more by way of return to the corporation than you will if you spend that same dollar for treatment programs. If you spend money on things like alcoholic rehabilitation programs, if you spend dollars on health screening and other relatively low-cost programs, it's a lot cheaper than letting the employee get to a point where he's completely derailed and then treating him in the hospital for the next 18 months. So hard financial reasons, as well as the humanistic viewpoint, have been the major influences in the development of corporate wellness programs. What are some of the specific practices that we see going on right now in American corporations? One is a real orientation toward health screening. Some corporations, for many years, have offered an annual physical at no charge to their employees. That practice is spreading widely. In some cases, it's done on a step-by-step basis, starting perhaps with a blood pressure screening program or an inoculation program, relatively low-cost kinds of things. And then from those early indicators of problems, employees that seem to match a certain profile are called back for further tests. For example, there are weighted medical history forms that you can take, wherein an employee accrues points for family history, certain disease entities in their history, their age, weight, general physical condition, and their lost time record. You can then create, in a very cost-effective way, profiles that can numerically and quickly target the potential problem audience. These techniques are becoming increasingly more sophisticated and more accurate and have really produced some very positive findings. Another thing that we're seeing are organizations that are offering full-blown stress testing programs. Many of these started primarily with the executive group because the corporations were very concerned about the big dollar investment that is made in leaders. But over the years, the programs have been cascading downward in the organization to include employees at all levels. A whole range of exercise programs are now in place, and I'm talking about corporations and factories who have bulldozed the South 40, land that's just been sitting there outside the building, and putting in running tracks and exercise yards and installing showers near the employee dressing rooms. In many cases, they've constructed buildings or have used unused warehouse space to put in a corporate gym. In some cases, where corporations didn't have the space for such additions, they've negotiated and received a group rate for health club memberships. The health club phenomenon is really a major growth industry in the United States. People in the country are responding to it. It's a hot topic in employee benefits circles, and it's certainly proving to be a very acceptable kind of benefit, particularly for younger employees who are part of that new culture and that new value system. A number of companies have sponsored jazzercise programs, basically importing the Richard Simmons concept into their own corporation. People like it. It's fun. And perhaps equally important, the employees are now meeting each other under corporate sponsorship in what is almost a social setting. What's happening to these employees is that they're becoming familiar with people who work in data processing, accounting, finance, and across the corporation, informal connection points are occurring which then help those employees in doing their jobs. It's such an obviously good idea that it makes you wonder why we've not done it before. A number of carefully controlled studies have now been done and are available to employers who may be interested from the Blue Cross and Blue Shield National Organization in Chicago. The studies show that the cost of treatment and rehabilitation programs drops when you invest money in preventive programs. You set up an exercise program, health screening, stress testing, a corporate gymnasium, is that really going to return money to you? The answer seems to be that it probably will. The corporations that started these programs felt that they were worthwhile doing, and that they would do them regardless of whether it returned any money to them or not. But in fact, in studies such as the one performed by Prudential Life Insurance, it has been found that these programs typically are lowering other costs. As you increase cardiopulmonary capacity in employees, as you identify where there are some employees who are a risk and didn't know they were a risk, as you encourage people to quit smoking by offering stop smoking clinics, what's happening on the back end is that they're having fewer heart attacks at work, fewer employees are claiming workman's compensation, and so forth. It's important to understand that there's a very good probability that you could reap a cost savings. A variety of other things can be done. Some of these are big, grandiose programs. Some of them are just little things. For example, in the cafeteria, if in addition to listing all of the items that are available on the line that day, you also list the item's calorie count, there are a number of people who, if they understand the caloric difference between an apple and a piece of lemon meringue pie, might go for the apple. Giving people that information can be very useful. Another way in which you can approach corporate wellness is to go beyond just the physical concerns and ask yourself, what is it that contributes to the well-being and the general satisfaction of employees? We know right now that one half of all the children in the country are growing up in single-parent homes. Typically, that means that boys and girls are living with a mother, and that a majority of those mothers are working. That means there are large numbers of women in the workforce who have very young children and who are worried about their kids. That's a big stress, because our children are so close to us that when something goes wrong with them, we panic, we worry, we have anxiety, and justly so. A number of corporations, as reported in attitude opinion surveys, have discovered that if they open a daycare center, or if they provide daycare services through an existing local daycare center, employee satisfaction with the corporation increases. It's also been found that such daycare centers serve as a major recruitment draw and as a major retention tool. That is, all things considered, a working mother or a working father with children will be very slow to leave an employer if that employer can offer, as a benefit, the absence of constant concern for his or her children, since the employee now knows that they will be in professional hands during the working day. For those employers that have daycare centers on site, they report that employees often use their break time, instead of getting a cup of coffee and smoking a cigarette, which is probably the worst thing they could do to relax, they will instead go down to the daycare center, look through the window, see little Susie, and that just does a lot for them. She's okay. We touch base. She's all right. I feel like, you know, she sees me a couple of times during the day. She doesn't feel abandoned. Can you put yourself in the place of that employee? And can you see the positive impacts that such a corporate program could have? Now, I'm not recommending any one of these particular corporate approaches or saying that any one of them would be feasible for you. But I am saying that you should stand back and look at corporate stress from the broader perspective of what employees are worried about, what stresses them, and perhaps even, when possible, let circumstances of their personal lives become a corporate concern. If you can relieve or reduce some of those distressful situations, I think you're going to see the response that other corporations have already seen, that people will work a lot easier and the workplace evolves into a more human environment. Hitherto in our program, we have talked about stress as though there were only one type. Typically, when people think of stress, they're thinking of it in negative terms. The proper word that stress researchers use to more accurately define that kind of stress is distress. By distress, we mean the negative, the unpleasant, the unpopular, the unwanted forms of stress. Yet the word stress has another possible definition: eustress, the opposite of distress. The prefix eu has the same meaning as in the word euphoria. And so eustress means a positive stress. We know, for example, that under distressful situations and under eustressful situations, the body will show some of the same heightened response mechanisms. The fact is that some stress is pleasant and some stress is not pleasant. A good strategy for dealing with the negative side of stress is to use eustress as an antidote for distress. Earlier we indicated that if you're under stress, one of the things you might want to consider strongly is getting involved in an exercise program. During exercise and physical exertion, the heart rate is up, the pulse is running, the blood pressure is perking along pretty good, and yet if you talk to people who have been in an exercise program and who perhaps just prior to that exercise program had been having a bad day, and you ask them, how do you feel now? You'll get different kinds of reports, but basically they'll fall into two categories. Some people will say, I'm really tired, but it's kind of evened out the rough edges. They're exhausted, but it's a good exhaustion. Other people who go through that exercise period will report an elation, an uplifted spirit, a heightened positive sense of well-being. And we've heard particularly from professional athletes who are exercising at extreme levels about almost drug-like reactions from the resulting production of natural chemicals called endorphins. These create an almost natural anesthetic for pain as well as a sense of heightened well-being. So injecting a eustressful exercise program turns out to be almost an antidote or a countervailing pressure against the distress that the day may have presented. Now, there are several other specific ideas that come out of this concept of coupling eustress with distress situations. One of these is a principle known as attitude reversal. We indicated that often stress comes from a perception of threat. If we can reverse our attitude about that and see that it is not a threat, but indeed a wonderful opportunity, if we can see the glass as half full rather than half empty, if we practice some of the principles we may have previously considered platitudes, there does in fact seem to be some truth to the idea that this rosy view of the world can often reverse our earlier negative and unhappy perceptions. Have you ever had the experience of buying a used car? You take it to the car wash for the first time, it goes through the car wash, all the paint comes off, all the rust spots and dents that you never saw on the lot now show. You take it back and say, "Look at this car, look at all the rust and the dents, look at how the paint washed off." And the car salesman says, "Yeah, it sort of gives it a sense of character, doesn't it?" And it's an old concept in selling that it's often not what it is you've got to sell, but how you sell it that counts. Sometimes this is known as the 180-degree principle. It's where you put a complete reverse spin on the situation. Can you somehow, in the midst of the negative stream, take a totally different viewpoint? I once worked for an executive who was a master at this. We'd all be discussing the problems of the day and how tough competition was and some of the objectives we weren't hitting. And it just, you know, the more we talked about it, the worse it seemed. And he would finally stand and would say, "Ladies and gentlemen, it seems to me we don't understand this. This is not an overwhelming problem. This is simply a test of our leadership greatness." Saying that to a room full of high achievement-oriented executives had a strong effect. Everybody sat back and squared their shoulders, and we started to look at it differently. I have worked with organizations who have been really concerned about their productivity problems. And if you talk to them and say that this is a wonderful time to be in management because the challenges to be faced in the next 5 years will probably be the best test that they will ever encounter of their leadership skills, I've seen an obvious change that causes in the expression, and it causes it immediately. If we can look at our problems through a different point of view, it's amazing how the whole burden of that situation will shift. In one of Shakespeare's plays, a character says, "Let us play the man." When you don't feel like it, be one. When you are most timorous, be brave and forthright. When you are feeling most scared, speak louder and more assertively. And if you can, in the midst of a situation that you perceive as distressful, see it in a totally different light, your attitude will reverse. Having reversed the attitude, you're now in a more neutral stance and better able to deal objectively with the problem. Try it. It is really amazing. A second illustration of what we're trying to get at here comes from Maxwell Maltz's classic text entitled Psycho-Cybernetics. A cybernet is a computer, and the concept of psycho-cybernetics is that the mind is very much like a computer, and what you feed into a computer, what you tell the computer to do, is what it can do. If you do not give the computer correct directions, then the computer will not perform correctly. You may have heard the gag line in data processing circles known as GIGO, which says that if you put garbage into the computer, that's what you're going to get out of the computer. Garbage in, garbage out. Sometimes we have an experience with the bank following up our checking account, and we say, "Aha, the computer screwed up." In fact, the computer never screws up. Some poor key puncher has made a mistake and has put wrong numbers into the machine. and all the machine can give back is what was put into it. One of the things that Maxwell Maltz noted was that the mind is very much like a psycho-cybernetic machine, in that how the machine is programmed is fateful in terms of determining how a person is going to act. The English philosopher John Locke once described the mind as a tabula rasa, the Latin phrase for blackboard, and he said that upon this blackboard, people write different messages. When a child comes forth into the world without any messages written upon his or her blackboard, and other people start to write those messages, what are the messages that the child hears? Well, some children will hear, "You're an idiot. You're stupid. You can't do it. You're ugly. You'll never amount to anything more than your Uncle Harry." And the child grows up with a picture of himself that other people have drawn upon that blackboard. We do not have any self-concept initially. That self-concept, that picture of the self, is drawn for us by others. We are programmed, said Maxwell Maltz, by the messages that other people have given to us. Others will grow up with people putting things into their computer or by writing on their blackboard, and they'll hear messages like, "You're fabulous, you're terrific, you're daddy's princess, you're wonderful, you're going to be president someday." There's an entirely different set of expectations and pictures and acceptance of the individual, and that, psychologists tell us, determines much of their behavior in later life. What kinds of programming did you receive in your life? Did you receive a you-stressful kind of program? Were people always putting you in the positive stress situation of achievement because they said, "I know you can do it. I know you're fabulous. You're great. I'm not satisfied with these grades yet because this isn't as good as you are"? Yes, I suppose some of that can be overdone, but you get the basic message. The people that expected a lot from you are probably why you have gone as far in your life as you have. And when you look back at these people, they are heroes. They are heroines. They are people you look up to. They are people you respect more than any other. With others that we have encountered in our life, it may seem that every encounter has been negative. They want to put something else in the machine. Psycho-cybernetics. Who did the programming? What kind of programming did you receive? I had a woman come up to me after a program that I'd done on stress management, and she said, "Clay, for 10 years I have lived in a marriage where my every behavior is criticized. I don't cook as good as his mother. I don't keep the house right. I don't raise the kids according to his concepts. I don't dress correctly. Every single message from morning until night is a continual critical feed-in to my life. The only way I have been able to survive is by doing what you've talked about." And I said, "Tell me what you did." She said, "I would go into the bathroom and lock the door and stare in the mirror and with the tears running down my cheeks say to myself, 'I am worthwhile. I am worthwhile. I am worthwhile.'" She said, "I found that unless I gave myself some positive messages, there wasn't any way at all I could deal with this continual stream of negative messages." Well, some might say she shouldn't have stayed in that marriage situation. I'm not making those kinds of judgments. I simply recommend the technique used by this very strong woman who discovered that if other people have not been giving you the right kinds of programming messages, it's very important that you do it for yourself. And I think perhaps that might be one of the definitive characteristics of maturity, when we learn finally to accept ourselves, to see ourselves in positive terms, and to have positive expectations for ourselves. Can we inject eustress into the distress around us? One way in which we might do it is through positive self-programming. And then, if you have the wisdom, look at the others who live with you now and who work for you and who work around you and ask, "What kind of programming am I putting into their world? And if they've got an unhappy life, can they encounter in me a positive life experience? Another aspect of this strategy of eustress injection is the old concept of positive mental attitude. For a long time, that was dismissed simply as high school pep talk, football rally, go get 'em, Tigers, do it for the Gipper. And yet there is a whole new definition and concept of the old concept of positive mental attitude that says, as a person thinks, so is he. It comes to us from the Vietnam experience, in which there were large numbers of soldiers who had been very severely wounded and in many cases had become amputees. One of the things that is known about people who undergo an amputation process is that for a considerable period of time, there is difficulty in accepting what is known as phantom pain, the sensation that says the leg is still there. Psychologists noted that some of the soldiers, when they were told by physicians and nurses that their legs or arms were gone, wanted to argue. No, they're not, they said. I can feel them. They're right there. There was a denial by the soldier of the physical reality. Now, this raised an interesting question. Yes, it is a physical reality that the legs are gone, but it's a psychological reality that soldiers who undergo that experience often report that they still feel it there. Now, which reality is more important? Which reality is more true? Is there a possibility that if we impose on a person who perceives the world one way, a perception of the world that is totally different from his own, that is, make them see themselves as a cripple who does not have arms or legs, are we really helping that person? Or would we be smarter to listen to their reality? It's an interesting question. So what they decided to do in a very interesting series of experiments was not to lie to the soldier, not to say your legs and arms are there because they didn't want to confuse them. But when the soldier would say, is it there? Is my arm okay? Is my leg okay? To redirect the question and ask the individual, what do you think? And the soldier would say, well, I think it's there. I feel it's there. Rather than insisting that they accept our version of the truth, the psychologist requested that the treatment team allow the soldier to come to that awareness that his leg indeed was gone. Now, what is the impact of each of the two approaches? Under the old system of, at the earliest opportunity, getting the message across that you're crippled, what that tended to do, they found, was create a long period of depression, a long period of dependency. It created a sense of dependence, a sense of, I need other people to do things for me. I can't do it anymore. I'm confined to this bed. I'm confined to this wheelchair. Understanding and accepting the truth in that fashion, contrary to their own internal psychological perception, tended to create that kind of behavior in the soldier. Under the second approach, where the soldier was allowed to come to the realization that he'd lost the arm or the leg in his own time, and could work through the feelings that said, hey, I can still feel it, I can move it, I can feel it responding, have come some very interesting differences in the recovery process. First, these people tend to stay in hospitals for a shorter period of time. Secondly, they tend not to go into as long a depression period. There was still a grief process, but it came as a natural process. The third thing that was noticed was that a lot of these people came out of the experience with a will to show that they were not crippled, not handicapped, exhibiting instead a refusal by the mind to accept the reality that they were so. From that perception has come a large number of stories you may have read about in the popular press, stories of downhill skiing by Vietnam vets who were blind, or single, double, or even triple amputees. Almost unbelievable acrobatic accomplishments have been accomplished by men who had accepted a different reality. You see what the message is here? When we think we can do it, we often can. And that is a very key understanding in rehabilitation programs today. When I believe that my version of reality is true, then I'm going to preserve body strength, preserve mental health, and preserve a purpose in life. Let's take a look at another dimension of the eustress phenomenon. One of the most popular sections in the Reader's Digest is the one entitled, Laughter's the Best Medicine. Humor induces, in fact, positive physiological and mental states. One of the things that suggests is that when you're having a very bad day, go do something fun. There may be something you always wanted when you were a kid. Maybe you didn't get the train. Maybe you didn't get the 10-speed when you were a child. Maybe you ought to go buy one and stick it in a closet and save that experience for some time when you are feeling really down. When was the last time you flew a kite? When was the last time you did a jigsaw puzzle? When was the last time you did some goofy, fun thing that you really enjoy? Can you structure some happy times around moments when you are least feeling like it? One of the great traditions in the history of funerals is the Irish tradition of the wake, where in the midst of a great personal tragedy there will be drinking and eating and storytelling and some teary songs and some happy remembrances. Those who have had that as part of their culture know how valuable it is and how positive it is. That very powerful principle can be followed in less acute situations than death. In part, one of the things we know from play therapy, from occupational therapy, from recreational therapy, all established fields of rehabilitation, is that people can be made well when the child that is within all of us is allowed to express itself. When was the last time you had some of the same happiness that you had when you were a child? If it's been a very long time, I'm sure you're not having a very fun life. Better get back in touch with that child who is still there. Inside each of you is that little boy or that little girl just waiting to get out.